In the United States, there are several creation science organizations that I've been active in for long years. One, you can get on all their mailing lists and you can get their literature. There's a fine organization in Australia that publishes a technical journal and a monthly creation science journal. Ken Ham came over from Australia and started something called Answers in Genesis. He gives lectures around the country. If you were to go to their website, you'll find endless apologetics tools with regard to creation science. ICR in San Diego is one of the oldest groups, founded by Henry Morris, who wrote a book along with John Whitcomb 40 years ago called The Genesis Flood, which is still excellent. I've known Henry Morris and John Morris and the staff for many years down there. I got an interesting email from PBC Cupertino. That's the, you don't mean I never heard of, South, Old South, New South. We're Old North, and they're New South. But anyhow, Bernard Bell tells me that they have a guest lecturer coming on Monday, March 17th. And you're all invited down to go hear Frank Sherwin give two talks, The Scientific Evidence for Creation, Dinosaurs and the Flood. And I would urge you to go down there. They'll have a book table. By way of a disclaimer, I gave you last week this wild, far-out talk on the velocity of light, that which I consider, I believe it, but it's also on the leading edge of science. There's an old saying that science is the only institution which makes progress by proving itself wrong. And that's the way science is. Theories come and go. There's always a little bit of tension between science and theology. I happen to be willing to live with a lot of tension between science and theology, as you know. Hugh Ross is a concordist. He's one of those people who likes to make science and the Bible agree with each other as much as possible to show that God's in nature. Now, that's fine. So I'm on one end of a wide spectrum of people who are interested in creation. I'm not, however, as nearly as interested in creation science or in apologetics as I am in just the Bible itself. So I much prefer just teaching the Bible. And so I'd urge you to do a little internet researching on your own and read some of these references, knowing that the whole picture of things will change eventually. As I said, science coming from our observations of nature eventually has to agree with the Bible, eventually, down the line. But the flawed human beings don't necessarily do a consistently sound process. Science is not always honest. There are lots of vested interests in the scientific community and so on. Okay? With those things said in mind, every week I read several commentaries and I read through the text. And then after I'm all done, I always pick up Ray Stedman, whose two books are in the bookstore, and I read through his wonderfully simple way of teaching. And I think, oh my gosh, why didn't I think of that before? Or, gee, I read this book several times, but I never saw that in here. And so I would recommend that if you're at all confused, just go look at what Ray says in his wonderful, plain style. Now we're at the flood of Noah on page 18 or so, 17. Last time we had this diversion on the which really has to do with the age of the universe. My belief that my claim that the universe is 8,000 years old and not many billions of years, and my claim that radioactive dates have slowed down drastically and the speed of light's not a constant, and so that allows me and my thinking to harmonize the Bible. I do believe that Noah didn't live very long ago. I believe that we have a clear continuous record from Adam to Noah to Abraham to Jesus, and we'll talk about that. We get into that a little bit next week. So I take the flood to have been a real historical event. But last week, two weeks ago, we looked at chapter 8. And I mentioned to you that in chapter 7, the description of the flood uses the Hebrew word kol, K-O-L, uses that word all, everything, the entire, uses it several times to emphasize that it's a total destruction of every living thing. It was a total global flood. The word for flood is the word mabul, which in Hebrew it means a catastrophic flood, not a local flood. When the Hebrew Bible was put into Greek, the word mabul was translated cataclysmos, cataclysm. So the flood then, I think, it was very clear that this isn't just a either a symbolic event, that it's a literal event. It wasn't local. You wouldn't spend 100 years building a big boat out in the prairie if you could go up, just walk a ways and get up on a mountaintop or something like that. So I think this was a great catastrophe. Then also we looked at 2 Peter and what the New Testament says. Peter's insistence that we tend to get into uniformitarian thinking and that God does intervene in history, has in the past and will in the future, so we ought to take that into account in our thinking. We can't just walk backwards in history using all the present observations of nature and expect that it's always been that way all the way to the beginning of time, way back to the Big Bang. That doesn't work very well. Okay, in chapter 8, we had Noah finishing the big ark and God calling all the animals two by two to get on board the ark. And, you know, we found also in all likelihood, Noah was a vigorous evangelist and had most likely been evangelizing. I don't know if they had radio and television or internet or what they had. Enoch in the seventh generation was an evangelist. I think we have to assume that the gospel spread widely through the antediluvian world, that probably great numbers of people came to know the Lord Jesus, saved by faith, by grace apart from works. And there will be, when we get to heaven, we'll find great numbers of people from the whole human race who lived during that time period, and they'll tell us all about it. The Bible focuses on the redemptive line that narrows down through Seth and leads to Noah. And by the time we get to Noah's time, the world was disinterested in God, totally apathetic. The fabric of society was all rotten and collapsing. It didn't do any good for Noah to urge people to get on board the boat. You get to this point of no return. So that's why at the time when it's time for the flood, when it's this pointed time for the flood, you get 8 people only. And I take that Noah did everything he could to persuade his neighbors. You find that with Rahab the harlot. Remember when she was getting ready to flee from Jericho, she was invited to bring all of her friends and neighbors in. And when Lot was being pulled out of Sodom, the angels told him he could bring in all of his friends and neighbors who wanted to be saved and they'd be given a safe escape. So that's God's grace. God's grace is extended out until the last minute. So it's interesting, however, that when we get to the time of the flood, we have 8 righteous people on the earth, 8 people who have placed their faith and trust in Jesus. God could have saved those 8 by a spaceship or something, but he didn't. He saves them by a boat with all these enormous numbers of animals and all the inconvenience of the animals. Think about that. It's kind of interesting to show God's love of nature, the world, our relationship with the animals, with the ecosystem, with nature, that's in that tender, loving care of our Creator for all that whole package. That's still part of the world we live in today. So there's a lot to think about here. This judgment was by water. Peter says it's sort of a picture of baptism. Baptism has the effect of washing away dirt and cleansing. Peter tells us that the next time God won't do this by water but by fire, that the next cleansing of sin will be a fiery one. I mentioned that the ark looked like and suggests a coffin. Death, burial, and resurrection are pictured in there. You get on board this boat and ride out this horrendous storm safely inside the boat, which is a picture of Christ. And when you emerge, you're safe and free. So there's all kinds of beautiful images of salvation and redemption in the ark. The length of the whole flood was a little over a year. Remember that it began with torrential rain for 40 days and 40 nights. Enormous rain. If this rain was only coming from the earth's atmosphere, it wouldn't amount to very much. But as I suggested, it's quite possible that when the fountains of the deep erupted, water was spewing up into the upper atmosphere, and so you get maybe continuous downpours, such that the whole earth is covered with water to a depth of 45 feet. And I've suggested that there probably were no great tall mountains at that time, so you don't have to cover Mount Everest. Maybe the highest mountains were only 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet. We've talked about the fact that the water is still here, that the ocean basins are deep enough to contain all the water, and the land came up afterwards. God shut them into the ark, and he closed the door, and that's a picture of our being sealed by the Holy Spirit when we come into Christ. We're sealed. The door's shut, and we're safe inside and can't get out. Don't want to get out. No windows. There's plenty of ventilation, but you can't watch out through there, and I don't think you'd want to watch out with it. You get seasick if you look at all the waves out there splashing around and thunder and lightning and storms. It's a great violent flood, and a lot to think about. God is silent, as far as we know. He didn't say anything to Noah during that time. He just said, hang out, hang in there, and it's all going to turn out right. And you can imagine that little ark, and it's not little, Titanic size, big boat, tossing and pitching and drifting and never turning over, but it certainly looked like it might some nights probably. And how would you like to be tossed around with your relatives, with your family, and all of these animals take care of for one whole year? And maybe you tell stories and sing folk songs, and there's no television or anything like that. So a lot of thinking about things, a lot of deep, thoughtful repentance, a lot of memories of families and friends left behind of the old world that's going to be destroyed. And what's it going to be like when we get out of the ark? What's this new world that God has for us? So I think it's good to imagine yourself in that kind of a situation. The flood ends at the about a year. I mentioned that the date the ark landed on Mount Ararat, according to some source, was what is now Easter Sunday morning. And I looked around, and where did I see that? And I found it in Ray's book, where it was in the first place. Because the calendars, the Hebrew religious calendar was changed in Exodus, so that the calendar was moved up 7 months. So if you look at the date that the ark landed here on Mount Ararat, it turns out that 3,500 years later, that's the date that Jesus rose from the dead. So the coming landing of the ark is a picture of the new beginnings. Okay? And I think that's probably fairly accurate. Okay, we stopped, if I remember, at verse 19 with the exit from the ark. There's all this business of releasing the raven, and it didn't come back, and turning loose the dove and waiting 7 days, and having the dove come back and turning the dove loose again, and having them come back with an olive leaf, that sort of thing. And so there's this delay by the time the ark has landed before you get to go out of it. So the waters are receding and plant life is coming up, and it's not going to be overly muddy when we get out. And so it comes a day that the ark opens up and Noah leaves and the animals leave. And now we've got to start all over again. We're going to have to find some housing and plant some crops, and we've got to take care of these animals. What's the very, very first thing that happens when Noah and his family come out of the ark? That's what happens in chapter 8, verse 20. Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. He had been asked by God to take an extra 7 pairs of clean animals in addition to the animals that would repopulate the earth. So obviously there was an anticipation of animal sacrifices well before the law of Moses, now remember, well before Abraham, animal sacrifice for the covering of sin. Animal sacrifice as an act of worship to show gratitude for God for the salvation that he's given you. So that's a good sign. That's a sign of Noah and his sons and their wives making a good start with life over again. The Lord smelled a soothing aroma. That's what worship is to God. Our worship and prayer is a pleasant odor and fragrance to God. And incense. The Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake. Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, neither will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. Now that turns out to be point two of a brand new covenant that God now puts into place with Noah, with his family, with the animals, with all mankind, with all creation. See, first part of that covenant is back in chapter 8 where it says, where did I write that down? Chapter 8 or did I just read the first one? God, he says, I wrote it down and forgot it. Oh, it's in chapter 6. Think. I will make a covenant. 6:18. Before the flood, New covenant. God says to Noah, I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your son's wife with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive, and so on and so on. So there's the promise there ahead of time of a new covenant, and that the new covenant is with Noah and his wife, and the animals are all included. Okay, now we're going to get the elaboration of this new covenant. We don't get a lot of discussion about covenants in the Bible until we get to Abraham. Then we get covenants all over the place. But I think by implication you could say that Adam had a covenant with God. A covenant is a contract. It's like a marriage contract or a bank loan or something is a covenant. God's a personal God. He enters into covenant relationships with individuals. We talked about that in chapter 2. Yahweh, I am who I am. He's the one who's covenant-making God. Well, now we're going to make a new relationship, change everything. After the flood, human relationships drastically change. As we'll see, we had before the flood, we had lots of things different than they are now. Well, most of the things that came into effect at the time of this covenant with Noah are still here with us. We still have them. And so we have to look a little bit and see what they are. In verse 21 of chapter 8, God promises never to curse the ground again. And he promises that the seasons will continue until the end of history, until the coming of the Lord. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and winter and summer and day and night shall not cease. That's it. See the regularity of the promise here for you can plant your crops. Doesn't mean you're always going to have a good year. But you can count on the sun coming up in the morning. You can count on a time period to plant, to sow, to reap, and God's care is going to be there. This is the first mention of definite seasons. And it's only just a suggestion that there may have been no real great seasons before the flood. Maybe there were. But we now look back on history and we can see some harsh winters and some famines and some rainy winters. But we still see the cycle of the seasons. And that's God's promise to us that there will be a regularity and predictability in nature within the bounds in the damaged universe. Okay? So God blessed Noah, chapter 1, and his sons and said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Repopulate the earth. It's been decimated. It was some billions of people and now it's down to 8. And you guys have got to spread out and repopulate the earth. And you think that God would know better than that to let sinful human beings whose imagination of their hearts is always evil, you think that he would know what the predicted result of that would be. Well, of course he did. But he nevertheless, by grace, is going to work with the descendants of Noah, as we'll see in the next couple of chapters. So there's a command here to be fruitful and to multiply and fill the earth. That's never been taken away. That's still in place. Well, we pretty well made the earth pretty well populated now, so there's not a lot of place to spread. But the fruitfulness is still there, obviously. The bountiful character of God is still with us. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, on all that moves on the earth, and on all the fish of the sea they are given into your hand. No mention earlier of animals being in fear of man. We get the picture in the early part of Genesis that although all the animals were not necessarily at home in intimate company with man, nevertheless, man could walk around, Adam could walk around without being attacked by a wild animal or a dinosaur or a tiger or something awful. There's a new violence in nature now. New violence in nature, and animals will mostly fear man. Animals could usually be tamed, but there's nevertheless, it's sometimes with difficulty and danger. I think Steve Irwin has a very short life expectancy if he keeps handling all those dangerous snakes. And I worry about the crocodile hunter. Steve Irwin's the crocodile hunter, and Jeff Corwin is the one that the young man who gets all these deadly snakes when there's no venom around for hundreds of miles. Anyway, we live in the kinship with nature and with the animals of nature, and they're still under our care. Our ability to manage the earth has been badly damaged. We still have that disrupted stewardship. It isn't working well, but we can't get away from it. Every now, Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I've given you all things just as the green herbs. But you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Now we get the idea that man and probably the animals before the flood were all vegetarian, herbivorous. There was no eating of meat before the flood. Now the eating of meat is allowed, and it's allowed as long as you drain the blood, which means kosher. And that's because the life is in the blood, as the scripture declares here. Now, your life is in your spirit, but there's some principle of the biological life is carried in the bloodstream, and this is certainly a very mysterious concept. And but it's tied in with redemption, and without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness of sins. And so the blood belongs to God, and he's signifying his ownership. Now, these dietary regulations, by the way, are temporary. As Ray points out in his book, that for a time, God put dietary restrictions on the Jews and divided animals between clean and unclean to teach things. But that in the New Testament reverses all that because everything's clean. You can go eat shellfish if you want to, and oysters and whatever you want, and there's nothing unclean to eat. Before the flood, man certainly lives by, if you eat plants, you probably can say, well, I'm eating this lovely vegetable has given its life for me. I'm thankful to God for this cauliflower and the asparagus and the rice and the beans because some living thing has died so that I could be sustained. Well, you can't put a great value on fruits and vegetables as far as sacrificing themselves. But now when you start killing animals and you start eating meat, it gets a little bit more, some living creature, some beautiful creature has given its life for me. It's right built into things. We live at the expense of nature, and nature, in a sense, gives life to us through the foods that we eat. It's the different level of God's administration over the universe. That old-fashioned word for that's dispensation, but that's such a bad word nowadays. People don't quite get it. But I think you get it. Things are different now, and also, verse 5: Surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. I will require it, and from the hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, because in the image of God he made man. Now we get here the institution of, probably a clear-cut institution of capital punishment and government. And I think you can make a case that before this point in time, the world was organized by patriarchs, by extended families with a patriarch. And if there were disputes between families, they were patriarchal disputes, that there were no regional governments. And now we get this institution of governments that comes into place. Well, we got governments in the world every place. Romans 13 tells us all about governments are instituted by God to maintain law and order. Without government, you have anarchy. That all governments are given the power of the sword to punish evil and the power even to capital punishment, I believe, and also to reward evil. And all governments, even bad governments, do seek to maintain law and order. And all governments will give account of themselves to God. So there's an institution of human government here. If you want to make a case for capital punishment, I think you build it right here, as many Christians do. capital punishment is probably a deterrent, as Ray points out again. But if animal sacrifices are a substitute for punishment, and you kill an animal, it's not much of a deterrent to other animals. You know, you're not going to persuade them by the fact that they've been killed for your sin that the animals should be better behaved. Obviously, this is justice. This is what you deserve. This is the principle of equal punishment. Equal crime deserves equal punishment, and that's going to show up in the law of Moses. This is way now before the law of Moses, before this all gets spelled out in detail, the operation of justice. And now this, of course, is abused. This statement here that blood is required for life shed is going to lead to all kinds of murder and blood feuds and vengeance and family feuds. It's going to be built into the whole Jewish system of the kinsman redeemer and the avenger of blood and the cities of refuge, and all are going to be attempts to deal with this part of the covenant with Noah. Quite a few Jews today, by the way, are renewing an interest in this covenant of Noah. They put 7 points in it. Ray puts 8 points in it. You'll find the Noahide covenant talked about in a lot of Jewish Messianic Jewish groups, because obviously it's still pretty important. Man is made in the image of God, so God's protecting that in all of us, and he's valuing all human beings regardless of their behavior, regardless whether they believe in him or not. There's what we'd call the sanctity of life principle here. And that would certainly apply to unborn children, certainly applies to prisoners on death row, it applies to awful, bad, evil people like Cain and others, and the grace of God's always available no matter how badly you need it. So that image of God adds basic worth and dignity to human beings, and ultimately the reason that Christ will come and die. In the meantime, the sin will be covered by animal sacrifices, Noah's sacrifices here. Look forward to the coming of the Messiah. Look forward to Messiah's coming, because he won't just cover sin, he'll take it away. That's in the future. Verse 8. Then God spoke to Noah and his sons with him, saying, "As for me, behold, I establish my covenant," Brit, first use of the word covenant, B-E-R-I-T-H, or B-R-I-T, Brit. I will establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. That's us. It goes all the way down to us, since we're all descendants of Shem, Ham, Japheth. And this covenant includes every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, the beasts of the earth, of all the go out of the ark, every beast of the earth, pretty all-encompassing, man and nature, man and animals. You better be careful about stepping on an ant, I guess, with this. If you're belong to that funny little religion down in India called the Jain religion, you know, they're very superstitious about killing flies and mice and rats and pests, because they think all life is sacred, and it's obviously carried too far. But look at God's loving care of nature here, I think, in a reasonable sense. We can certainly get rid of pests and mosquitoes, obviously. But thus I will establish my covenant with you. Two-way promises. You know, you're obligated to respond to the covenant, but God offers this. It's unconditional and on his part. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Now, you'll have a lot of local floods. The Great Flood of Lisbon is a well-known historical event in which there was an earthquake and the water receded and came in and destroyed, what, 1 million people in Lisbon or something like that. We've had local floods, what, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, even the coal mine districts and Jamestown. And some of these historic floods have been awful. Certainly if you're in the middle of it, you didn't care whether it was local or global, it got you. But there's never going to be a cataclysm that will destroy the world. Protected. So no matter how bad things get on earth, there's nevertheless God's overarching sovereign protection in accordance with this covenant. Covenants very often carry signs with them, sort of steps of sort of authentication. With Abraham, it's going to be circumcision. Here's the sign of the covenant. God said, "The sign of the covenant, which I make between you and me and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations, I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth, and when it starts to rain, that the rainbows will be seen in the cloud. And when I see the rainbow, I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth." God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant which I've established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." Now, it's very interesting that the term everlasting covenant is used, because that's generally used to refer to the new covenant. And I think you could make a case here that all of the covenants, behind all of the covenants is this everlasting covenant. What God has always wanted is your faith and trust. No matter what the externals of the law of Moses are all about, he doesn't want you to try to follow the law. He wants you to come to the end of yourself and put your trust in him. So this is one of those covenants where you won't be able to do your part unless you're putting your faith and trust in the invisible God and his promises. So now there's this first mention of the rainbow. And so this would lead you to think, well, maybe it didn't rain before the flood. Can't prove that, maybe. Maybe there were rainbows before the flood. Maybe not. Maybe the storms have started up now with the changing climate, the changing weather systems, our Earth flipping on its axis. We now maybe get, instead of water coming from the mist and the dew and coming out of the subterranean springs, now maybe we begin to get rain. And with rain comes that beautiful phenomenon, rainbows. We get them around here. A pot of gold at one end. I don't know what's at the other end. I haven't ever been to either end. And sometimes you'll see multiple rainbows, and that suggests immense wealth and riches waiting if you could chase it down. But rainbows are extraordinarily beautiful as the water droplets break light into its spectrum. And they're phenomenal. You see them from the air, you'll see them as circles. If you ever looked out at airplane window and there's rain going on below, you'll see a circular, totally circular rainbow.
Or, no gold in that one.
No gold in there, no. You go around in circles there. of course, God doesn't have to be reminded to look at the rainbow and be reminded of his covenant. That's just a little expression here of that he's putting rainbows there for our benefit. And when you see a rainbow next time, you can remember that this is God's part of the ongoing covenant with Noah. And if the flood was 3,500 years ago, then this has been in effect for 5,500 years. And if you'd like to go to atomic time, we could make it hold longer. Okay?
Geriatric.
There's a... The velocity of light would be the factor. Arthur Custance has a wonderful book, and his website's on the internet, and his book is called Time and Eternity, and he talks about psychological time, about the sense of time dragging when you're young and speeding up when you're old, and never enough time to do things, and always in a hurry, and being bored, and all those things that are all the time's damaged. In other words, it's out of kilt. I remember when Arthur Custance used to write little papers called doorway papers, and he'd mail them, and I got on his mailing list, Ray got on his mailing list, and we'd sit down and talk. When the new doorway paper would come out, Ray and I would sit down and compare notes, and I would treasure those times. They all ended up in books, and the library ended up in the custody of his secretary, Evelyn White, and so we got it all on the internet, and it's all there. Arthur Custance, a wonderful Canadian scholar, has got a lot of great stuff. If you find his website and read Time and Eternity this week, then next week you can read his wonderful book, Noah's Three Sons. Wish it was in printed form, because we're going to use that and a couple other books as we trace the history of Shem, Ham, and Japheth after the flood. So Custance was a really neat guy. He came here, Ray had him down to PBC, I think, in the 60s or something, maybe early 70s. And he came down here and spoke. Anyhow, great man. Fine man. Now, where were we? We were. Verse 18. Now, the sons of Noah, these were the sons of Noah who went out of the ark, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. That's out of place, but we have to get to that later. These were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. No other survivors from the flood. People raise that idea that there were other races, that there were other survivors, that there are other human beings on the earth that are not descended from Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Yeah, I think it's pretty clear here. Everybody in this room has the genes of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, or a combination of them, and you all have Noah's genes right in their genome, and the genome's pretty complicated to allow for all this diversity. I mentioned also earlier, and this gets fun now, that Shem, Ham, and Japheth are always mentioned in that order, all the way through the whole Bible. And Japheth is the firstborn, so he ought to be number one. Shem is the secondborn, so he ought to be number two. And Ham's the thirdborn, and he's in the middle. And why in the world are these three named in that order? Well, once again, I'll borrow from Arthur Custance. Shem is going to head up that group, that part of mankind whose special religion, whose specialty will be religion. The Semitic peoples of the world descend from Shem, and from them will come the Jewish people, and from them will come the Bible, and the descendants of Shem will have a special interest in religion, in the spiritual realm. So it would be very logical that you put the spiritual realm first. Okay? What is Ham? Ham now becomes... The the people of Africa, the Chinese, the Orientals, the Indians, the native Indians of the world, not people from country India. And these people are the inventors, craftsmen, artisans. That's their great specialty. And I so show you this in subsequent weeks. So Ham is a perfect, I give you a perfect picture of the servant. It's got a man as a servant. Man as religious, man as a servant. Well, then what's Japheth? Most of us in the room here are Japhethites, Europeans, not all of us. Europeans, well, what are we known for? We are, of course, our philosophy, technology, science. What are we? The things we believe in come up out of Greek philosophy. Our science comes out of Greek thinking. We're the intellectuals. Huh? Look how that's last here. We spiritual first, servanthood next, intellectual last. Now, Matthew, Mark, Luke. Same order? Matthew, Gospel to the Jews. Message of the Messiah coming to the Jewish people, coming to Shem, the message, Gospel to Shem. Mark, Gospel to Ham. Luke, the Greek physician, intellectual, scholarly, careful. Gospel to the Europeans, the Gospel to Japheth, okay? Well, now that's a funny coincidence, isn't it? Only coincidence isn't a kosher word, as Chuck Missler likes to say. When Jesus was born, he was visited by three groups of people. In the following order, he was visited first by the shepherds who were watching their flocks there by night. And guess who they were descended from? Shem. Then came wise men, probably make a case that they were from Ham, from the east. And then Greeks. Okay? Jesus had to carry his cross. So we start with the cross being carried by Jesus, who's descended of Shem. Does anybody help him along the way? Who? Simon of Cyrene, who is? Hamitic. Who is the one that puts the sign on the cross over his head? This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Herod. Japheth. Ham and Japheth have a role in the crucifixion? Yeah, well. How about the gospel? How did the gospel go? How did it start? Start in Jerusalem to the Jews? Who's the next person to hear the gospel? Ethiopian eunuch, Ham. And then where does the gospel go? It goes to the Greeks and the rest of the world. Shem, Ham, Japheth, kind of get it? I think this is one of the God's little secrets. Now, we're going to see one human race, one family of men, not race says, plural. Each race having its distinctives. Part of the problem that we have in getting along with one another is we don't appreciate the things that a certain group of people is especially good at. We want everybody to be good in the things we're good at, and we don't appreciate the giftedness that God has put in the race. And if you think about what is the greatest gift here is in the spiritual realm, and the next gift is going to be in the servant realm. All the great inventions in the world have come from Ham. All the great technology comes from Ham. And Japheth, us, most of us Japhethites, would get down third on the list. Intellectual pride is very bad. So, okay? Now, we got to get Noah drunk here. the earth is populated. Okay, now we don't know how much time's gone by. Some time's gone by and they've gotten out and made tents. Somebody suggested they might have torn the ark apart and built houses. And then there's the argument that the ark was so well built and it was all caulked with tar that it probably, and it might have been pretty smelly inside after a year at sea with all these animals. And maybe you just leave it and take a few possessions, but you go down and make tents. Start life right over again. This is your ranch. It's going to look like pretty primitive for a while. But at some time period goes by, and time enough for Noah to plant a vineyard. They probably had vineyards before the flood. Arthur Custance thinks that wine before the flood had less alcohol in it. That's his personal view. I don't know what he's right. So that Noah was unprepared for what the effects of drinking wine would be. He was used to the old wine that was not much alcohol, and he drank this new wine, got him drunk. He drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. Now, there's nothing bad said about Noah getting drunk. He's not taken into court for getting drunk. So maybe it's a one-of-a-kind careless afternoon after watching football on TV or something or other. And he's older now, but we're going to see the original sin is with him. Now, earlier we found out that Noah was blameless before the Lord, that Noah was righteous before the Lord, and that doesn't mean that he never sinned. It means that he rebounded and took God's forgiveness and went on, and we assumed that he did. We assumed that he had a talk with the Lord about, I'm sorry, I got drunk and all this trouble came. Now he's drunk and it's a hot afternoon in his tent. Those camping tents, canvas camping tents, get hot on this hot day, and he becomes uncovered. His robe falls away, and there he is, which is okay as long as he's alone in his tent. But his son Ham, who, once again, we're told that Ham has a son named Canaan. Canaan, this is second mention of Canaan, who's incidental to this event. Ham, the son of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it on their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away and they did not see their father's nakedness. Now that's a very controversial passage, and you'll find all kinds of points of view. Was there some kind of a sexual immorality going on here with naked Noah and his son? I don't think so. I think Ham's sin is in boasting about his father's nakedness to his brothers, and talking about his drunk, naked father there laying in the tent, and dishonoring his father in that manner, which in the ancient world would be a very serious thing. To uncover the nakedness of can mean some sexual activity going, can mean that. Doesn't always mean that. I'd leave that to you to think about that further. At any rate, in some sense, Noah is greatly dishonored by his son Ham, who evidently, see, we suggest that Ham doesn't have the moral sensitivity here that his brothers have. He's not as sensitive about family values and honoring your parents. And maybe there's some inherent lasciviousness in him that is there. And his brothers are shocked by this, and they go in and cover their father up, but don't look at him naked. So, okay. Now, Shem and Japheth take a garment and did not look on their father's nakedness. Noah awoke from his wine. Gets up. They have a little family. His wife comes there. Somebody tells him what has happened. He wakes up from his stupor, drunken stupor. And he says now, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers. Now, that's funny, because you think he'd say, shame on you, Ham. Go do some push-ups. I want you to go. You're going to have to do all the family chores around here. We don't do things this way. I want to see some real repentance from you. He didn't do that. He doesn't say anything to Ham. He jumps right over Ham, and he talks to his grandson, Canaan. When his grandson, now let's suppose that his grandson now is maybe an adolescent. And Noah's quite up in years. He was 601 when he got off the ark. So he's up in years a little bit, by our standards a little bit. And he says, cursed is Canaan. And I don't think this is the kind of the curse where he's pronouncing some kind of terrible judgment. Let me tell you what I think. And then I want you to go look and see what other people think. I think that this wise Noah wakes up and he says, you know, I've seen in my son Ham, I've seen this moral weakness. I've seen this lust that comes out, this lack of discipline with regard to things that are immoral and wrong and dishonoring. But I see the same thing in my grandson to an even greater degree. My grandson is now, and it's like father, like son, and I see sadly that the weakness in Ham has come out in Canaan, and I predict that in Canaan it's going to go to the great extreme. Well, now, historically, we know that Canaan, the grandson, becomes the progenitor of the Canaanite peoples who move into what is now Israel and multiply over hundreds of years and become all those Canaanite tribes with their terrible idolatry, ungodliness, immorality, lack of any redemptive hope or spirit for a long time. You can sort of predict that in somebody. A wise father can sort of see that coming, maybe in a grandson. Doesn't want it to happen. It isn't like I'm going to make this happen. It's like, sadly, I think that's what's going to happen. So I think that's it. A servant of servants he shall be to his brothers. Now, there's nothing particularly pejorative in that. For Ham to be a servant is not any different from having Jesus be a servant, really. This is not a put-down on Ham at all. Ham's role in life is going to be servanthood. And remember the Gospel of Mark, But there's something in this whole thing going on with Ham that he's kind of disqualified from higher service, and his role is going to be to serve the family. It is, in a way, I think, a kind of a consequence here. Now, if we look down through the race, down through the history of human race, can you see the Hamitic peoples being subjected to slavery? Well, yes, you can. Ham had other sons, one of which would be the black people. Another son was going to be the Indian people that, in general, have been enslaved and overrun and turned into servants, and also by nature are good servants. And remember, servanthood is really high up on the list of things that God values about us. So we get now this very cryptic. He continues in this very cryptic message, and please go read up on this, because this is there's a lot packed in here that I'm just giving you my point of view. He said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem." Now we're going to, Noah takes this point, he's got his sons and his grandsons and his family, and he's going to do a little predicting in his old age, a little prophesying, a little looking forward, and he sees Shem as the one with the love for God, the love for truth, the one who's going to be able to write down the scriptures eventually, one of his descendants. Is. One of his descendants is going to be the promised Messiah that God promised would come as a descendant of Eve a long time ago. Blessed be Shem, the God of Shem. May Canaan be his servant. That's interesting. Now, that would sort of... Now, if you look back at, say, European history, and you look at the worst that's come out of... Or history in the Middle East, and you look at all the forms of slavery and bondage and servitude in one group being superior to another. May God enlarge Japheth. Enlarge Japheth. Japheth becomes the world explorers. Magellan and Spanish and the Portuguese, and they go out. These are the people that explore the known world, and it's the history of Western civilization. It's exploiting. Okay? May he dwell in the tents of Shem, over alongside of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. Now, there's a particular close affinity between Shem and Japheth here. They're going to sort of dwell side by side. I think this would mean, read a lot into this here, that the Western civilization will borrow more readily from Shem than anybody else, than, say, Eastern civilization in the East. We're going to, our Greek mentality is going to find affinity with the Bible. We're going to find it easier to incorporate the Bible into our thinking. Many people have pointed out that you get Western science and philosophy only in the context of biblical presuppositions down underneath. So there's this kinship between Japheth finding affinity with Shem and Canaan being his servant. What happened as the Western world expanded and conquered the New World and Africa? What did Japheth do? Well, we overran all the Indians and wiped them out, and we went down to Africa and hauled millions of slaves out of there. And these were all Hamitic peoples, in general. Now, that's very simplified. If you read Testament, you can see this, I think, a little bit more clearly. So it's well worth reading Customs. Noah lived after the flood 350 years. So he's 601 when he gets off the flood. He's got 350 years of post-flood living, watching his family grow up and his children grow up and marry, and good number of people being born that are all his descendants. The days of Noah were 950 years, and he died, still living as long as any of the patriarchs before the flood. No decreasing lifespans yet. He's whatever is going to cause human lifespans to shorten hasn't cut into place yet. Now, the next two chapters are called the Table of Nations, and they're marvelous. This is a goldmine of the only information we really, really have on the early history of the race, of human race, from a biblical point of view, apart from secular speculation. So that's what we'll want to get into next time. Is chapter 10. Okay, what do you think about all this? Dissensions, alternate points of view, contradictions. Apparently. I think so. That would be my take on that, yeah. But it isn't spelled out specifically earlier in Genesis, so we have to be a little tentative about that. It just says a mist went up from the earth and watered the whole ground, and that's about all it says. I think that's right. I think that's quite reasonable. And I think that if we have a warm, humid, subtropical climate, and the Earth may have had a slightly different axis tilt, that we probably had this uniform climate everywhere, and probably a heavy dewfall at night, and then lots of spring water. That'd be my take on that. I think these major storm seasons are post-flood. And also the volcanic activity is going to be in this. The volcanism and other fossil deposits and things.
In 8:22, it says, while the earth remains,
yes, forever. Yeah, and that's right. And we get that eventually in 2 Peter and the new heavens and the new earth. And yes. So there is a great judgment coming again at a point in time when men are no longer savable and the fabric of society is rotten all over the place and we're destroying each other, and next week or 2 weeks or a month or next year, 100 years. Steve?
The descendancy here from the curse on Canaan, that would not have necessarily applied to the other
side no.
of Ham, right?
That's right.
It's a fairly specific.
Yeah, and so that making black people your slaves, you see, a lot of people took this part of Genesis and used that as a justification for slavery, and it isn't talking about the black people at all. It's talking about the Canaanites, and the Canaanites lived pretty much in Jordan and Israel, this is not the Egyptians, and it's not the Ethiopians, it's not the Libyans. Those are other sons. We'll talk about those. So this is a very narrow judgment on one son, and not on Ham really either very much.
And I mean, one way of looking at this is that the first people reading what Moses wrote were people going to displace the Canaanites.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yeah. Because when Moses writes this down, it's during the Exodus, and the Jews are on their way to their promised land, which is in the possession of the Canaanites, who God has given them 400 extra years. So that the iniquity of the Amorites, the Canaanites, would be complete before their judgment. So this is all the people that Joshua fought. These were the people that God said, utterly destroy. Don't take in their gods. These are the people that the Jews compromised with and fell into their idolatry and caused so much problem. That one son, Canaan. But now, if you see the diversity that God's built into the human race, the wide variety of gifts He's built, not only in us as individuals, but in the branches of the human family, and that you take Shem, Ham, and Japheth, you have to add up all those qualities to get what God considers a whole person. Those are all, in a way, every one of these is going to be a picture of Christ for us, if you want. These are all believers, too, at this point. None of them has turned away from God. So the whole human race, you see, look at what this implies about how much mankind knew about God when civilization began to rebuild after the flood. How much did people know? Well, they knew all about the flood. They knew all about animal sacrifices. They knew all about their parents and grandparents. And they sat down for 300 years and Noah had told his grandchildren stories of what it was like before the flood. Lots and lots of information. Now that's not called the progress of man. That's called the deterioration of man, when civilization's going downhill, not uphill. Yes, ma'am. Arthur Custance, C-U-S-T-A-N-C-E, custance.org will get you his website. They're all out of print. Every single... The Seed of the Woman, it got back into print. This is the Seed of the Woman's a wonderful suggestion as to why we had to have a virgin birth. No, probably not. Pardon me? Different races. One human race. Three branches. Now, there's been considerable intermarriage in not everybody in here is a pure descendant of Shem or Ham or Japheth. In most cases, not always. But one race, three branches. Okay? Yes?
Let me get a little geeky on
you. Yeah.
If you take the quotient derivative, right, of the slowing down of human age, human longevity, over time, compare that to the derivative of what's happening with the speed of life.
Doesn't fit.
There's no correlation.
No. Did I give you a curve on the longevity of the patriarchs after the flood? I think I did already. It doesn't fit any known explanation.
What about looking forward? Okay, with the slowdown of the speed of light, is there anything that we can anticipate?
No.
Either in nature or
the speed of light's not now slowing down hardly at all. Moses in Psalm 90 says he talks about 70 or 80 years as being the normal lifespan. What it's going to shrink down to, but Moses lived to be 120. Well, Peter talks about that. When we read 2 Peter, we talked about the elements being unloosed by fire. That's the word that we use for atomic elements. Unloosed would be the kind of releasing of the fire, of nuclear fire, if you want.
Fire.
No, not that I know of, because that comes at the end of the millennium. Comes at the end. I'm being very literal now and pre-trib, pre-mill, like I think. And so that after the 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth, and the devil's turned loose a little short time, and then permanently thrown into the lake of fire, we have what's called the new heavens and the new earth, which is, I think, a renewing by fire of the heavens and the earth, cleansing. When we'll all be there. Ray talks about this in the last chapter of his commentary in Revelation. And the second law of thermodynamics being reversed and renewing and cleansing and so on. Good stuff. Isn't this fun to read? Just the text itself. I think I've always believed the power is right in the Word of God, and that you get plenty of discussion if you just read the Bible and think about it a little bit. Father, thank you for this... compact but powerful account of early events after the great flood of Noah. Father, please help us to rethink everything that we've ever learned in school and thought about that we could begin to see and think biblically about our history, our relationship with one another as descendants of Noah, about culture and history, because all of these, the secular view of things is so far amiss of what the actual record is. And how good of you to give us a clear insight into the way things really happened. And how wonderful it'll be to look forward to your libraries when we can go and learn all we want to learn about things that we can only just see through a glass darkly right now. I pray, Father, that you would just continue to stretch our thinking and our horizons and grant us increasing joy and enthusiasm as we anticipate the future. Thank you for our security in Christ, for your protective care over us, your watchful care. Thanks for choosing us. May we be worthy of the men and women who've gone before us and of the Lord Jesus. Amen.